sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets react to central bank largesse, new highs for stocks, and new lows for bonds. Global terror attacks on the rise and a coup attempt thwarted. All this and much more on episode number 468 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, yeah, I'm back from a crazy time in Asia. We'll talk a little bit about that today. This is Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All the way through 468 episodes with some amazing guests over the years and some great times with my listeners. And thank you so much for sticking around, for joining me. If you're new, there's a lot to know, a lot to catch up on, because we've been barreling through all sorts of information regarding markets, theory of market investing, and all sorts of other financial goodies over the years. You can listen to all the back episodes over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just go to the podcast area. As a matter of fact, there's a really cool area you can look at that says podcast summary. This is something new where you can actually search by guest, search by topic, search by stock symbol, anything that was mentioned during the show in terms of any of those items. You can click on and simply then filter the list of all the shows that we've had. Yeah, some of the beginning ones, we didn't really keep up with all of the guest items and topics and stocks that we mentioned on the show. But nonetheless, let's say the last 350 or maybe even 400, we have been. So you can actually go over there to the podcast summary. This is something that's kind of new. And then you can actually filter down and see all sorts of details on maybe just one guest or maybe on just one stock, and then play the episode right from there. So it's a great tool to actually utilize if you want to really filter down on one particular item. A lot of people have a favorite guest. You probably have one. And what you can do is just simply go over to that guest and say, oh yeah, let me just see what shows they've been on. Click it and to see the list, and then just listen to their particular commentaries over the years. Well, yeah, I was over in Myanmar, the old Burma, or maybe it's the new Burma. Anyway, it used to be called Burma. Now it's called Myanmar. And I actually did some diving in Thailand. Just a quick quickie on this. Some listeners sent me emails and some Twitter requests for a little bit of a background. I talked a little bit about the trip on the DH Unplugged show last week. But this is probably one of my, I would say, my more interesting and eye-opening places that I've been. In terms of the stark difference between what we have here and what others don't have, just generally speaking, over there. A lot of over theres. Now, I've been to Vietnam, I've been to Cambodia, I've been to Morocco, I've been all over China, from north to south, all over Europe, parts of Central and South America, Canada, all over the U.S. I'm sure I'm missing a few things here in Russia. Now, I got to tell you something. Myanmar was quite interesting in that it's such a poor country, or at least compared to the material items that we see, think about, and concern ourselves with each and every day here in the U.S. Now, I may not be speaking for you exactly, but you know what I'm talking about. I mean, we have the luxury of things that maybe we just take for granted, right? We know this. We know about air conditioning and central heating, and we know about having electric throughout the house that works all the time, internet that has high speed, televisions in every room, maybe a pool, running water, hot and cold, when we want it to be hot and when we want it to be cold. It's a big difference from some other places around the world. Now, that doesn't mean that they won't have this in time. As a matter of fact, the big thesis of many of, for years and years, The thesis of Templeton's group on emerging markets was very, very bold about the concept that there is a major amount of catch-up that's going to happen. The globalization trend is introducing many of the markets around the world that don't have many of the things like air conditioning, like refrigeration, like electricity, like running water. This is going to be a real significant developmental change in the emerging markets over the years, and it did happen. So we saw that happen. Now, there's still outlier areas. This is a place that the military was in control of the government till about, I think it was maybe 10 years ago or so. And now they are still trying to dig out and create a society. I think it was when I was there last, a couple of weeks ago, it was the first time the stock market ever in the history of Myanmar was open. In other words, it just opened. It was two stocks trading. Not a day trader's paradise by any means, but it was a historic moment that a stock market was actually opened and it had stocks, publicly traded companies that were funded by the public in Myanmar. Pretty impressive. Now, I went very quickly from Yangon, used to be called Rangoon, which is the capital, the new capital. And I went up there and I checked out some of the really cool things down to Ely Lake, which was just beautiful. This is a lake that you take the long tail boats. If you haven't seen what a long tail boat is, look it up. It's a single cylinder engine. They have the same engines on their trucks because they utilize the belts to harness off of the truck onto other instruments throughout the farming, through maybe bringing up, cranking up water from a well. It's used for a variety of things, and it's easy to move from one, what would that be called? Flywheel, and take the belt and put it on that one and attach it to something else and utilize that same engine that was turning the transmission and turning the wheels on the trucks and many of the farming trucks and boats to use in other ways. So we took this boat down the Ely River and Ely Lake, Inlay Lake. And what was really cool was that all the houses on stilts that were lined up all across and all up and down the whole ride, miles and miles of this, just incredible views. But how poor it was and how they're living off the lake. As a matter of fact, the lake has all the brush and various foliage that is stamped down. And on there, throughout the canals that are then created by these stamping down of all the foliage, on there is how they farm. It's kind of like hydroponic farming on a lake. Tomatoes, cucumbers, eggplant, all sorts of things. Spices are grown on the lake. Well, we took this longboat down for about an hour ride and made a left and a right and a left and right. And finally, we arrived at Mr. Min's. This is a cooking class right in the middle of this neighborhood of Stiltville on a lake. And we created 10 different dishes. And when I say a little place, I'm talking about maybe 15 by 15. That was the entire cooking school on a stilted platform with a exterior, another 15 by 15 that stuck out, had some umbrellas there with a table. So we put the food on there and waited after we cooked everything to eat right there on the lake in the middle of everything. What a view. What a fascinating experience in cooking, kind of almost in a medieval style, because that's all they have there. Anyway, went down and looked at Bagan with all the pagodas. And I put some pictures up on the DH Unplugged show. And I put some pictures on Twitter if you follow me there. Andrew Horowitz, one word, is the Twitter handle. Really cool stuff. I mean, just a really cool stuff. Then I did some diving in Thailand in a very rocking island called Koh Samui. This is, if you ever want to go party and you feel like traveling, by the way, it's a long way to get there. But if you ever feel like traveling and partying, Koh Samui is the place. This was a rocking island. Outdoor bars on the beach with DJs, kind of like a constant rave going on there. You should have seen me. It was pretty impressive. You'd be proud of me. I was raving. I was hanging. I was doing. And the mojitos were, let me just say, extra mojito-y. Wow, they were strong. Anyway, since I was gone, markets have done kind of a, A roller coaster doesn't really describe it well enough, does it? It's more of a convulsive type of thwarting of just belching. It's just a horrible, all sorts of moves that it was very unsavory and unseemly. And then all of a sudden, like a light switch went off. People are like, not so bad. Let me talk about that for a minute. What happened? We had the Brexit panic that sent the global currencies in just an absolute panic mode all over the place. We had the, 8%, 9% drop of the pound against the dollar, 14% against other currencies. We had the yen gaining towards 100, actually clipped 98 for a short period of time. So bonds just move in an incredible way. 10-year bond in the U.S. at 1.4%. We saw that there was also a similar move in European bonds, further into negative territory. Same thing with Japan's bonds. And what was interesting was that all of the moves ended up in being the historic low for yield on bonds across the board. There was definite panic. Markets were off by 7 to 10%. The U.S. fared a little bit better. But it was pretty ugly there for about 2 or 3 days, 4 days maybe. And then what happened? Why did markets turn around? Have you thought about what changed? Was it that, Brexit isn't happening and now we're just going to celebrate and party? No, not really, because if Brexit wasn't happening, markets still were, questioning whether earnings were going to be good and what was happening with yields. Well, I'll tell you what happened. If you really think about it, very simple. Because of the panic that was being brought up and investors were concerned, and what really happened was that the central banks panicked. Central banks got so unnerved about all this that they said, you know what, we will do whatever it takes. And this was on the heels of already a very stimulative and a very loose economic policy by all of these central banks. You had Japan come out and say that they will defend the yen. You had European ECB talk about how they will make sure there's liquidity, and the United States say, hey, we're not going to raise rates right now. And, with all of this, if we have to create liquidity, we will. So what happened was that markets dropped, they panicked, they injected all sorts of liquidity in there. And even without the injection of liquidity, their commentary about putting a safety net underneath markets made investors believe that they would be there doing things like additional quantitative easing, buying bonds, injecting all sorts of money into the economy, and doing what they can to work their currency desks in order to make sure the currencies would be at least somewhat stable. And for that matter, in the UK, so far as to say that, even though our currency dropped already about 10% with this Brexit, we're not going to let this become a problem for the economy. We'll be pushing it even lower by utilizing a variety of stimulative measures that we haven't done in years, maybe even lowering rates. So in the heads of investors was this whole idea that, good news. The Fed, central banks, ECB, BOJ, BOE, they're all going to be there. And then a few days later, there was the realization on top of this that maybe, just maybe, the Brexit wouldn't happen, or it won't be as bad as could be. Because this referendum that was actually passed, it's just a referendum. It is the will of the people, it's the majority, etc. We saw David Cameron step down. We saw a variety of other financial ministers from the UK step down. But the official withdrawal from the EU has to happen after the government actually invokes Article 50. It's called Article 50. And what this does is it creates a countdown of 2 years until such time that the EU and the country that is putting in their withdrawal notice, if you will, says, okay, we're done. And the realization again of, hey, wait a minute. This is going to take 2 to 5 years probably. If, in fact, the government goes along with the will of the people, because we know we've seen things like this. Remember how we saw a major change in government in Greece, where there was a desire for Greece to no longer be under the ominous and very heavy-handed workings of austerity measures by the ECB and the EU. And do you remember what happened? A new government came in because there was an uprising. And they put in a government that said that basically, hey, you know what? If, in fact, we get in, we are going to tell them to stick it. We are not going to pay the bonds. We're going to let the bonds default. We're going to make sure that unemployment is higher. We're going to possibly even pull out. Well, what happened? They get into government. They get into place. The people basically voted in a referendum style, but it was a vote. They voted them in. And then they said, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's not such a good idea. Maybe we'll see how it goes. Maybe we'll try to negotiate for maybe some lower rates and maybe some concessions here. But I know I said this, but so that whole thing could be the model for what's going on right now in the UK, the potential for them not to actually go through the whole process. Now, that would create a whole stir, clearly. However, that being the case, now we still have all the stimulus that's in the market, the conversations by the central bank saying that they do anything that can be, pushing down bond yields substantially, and now all of a sudden, maybe or maybe not, Brexit's going to happen, and the question about how that's really going to affect things is kind of in the past. So markets, what do? Well, they see that rates are low. They see there's liquidity in the markets. They see that the potential for a hand under all of this is there, and there's been a lot of conversation by central banks. So, you know what? The heck with it. We're buying. That was the kind of mentality of institutions, even some retail investors. As a matter of fact, last week was the first week in a number of weeks there was actually a positive flow by retail investors into ETFs and mutual funds. We haven't seen that in months. And this is when we're hitting all-time highs on the S&P 500 and the Dow. All-time highs. People say, maybe now's the time to invest. Seems a little upside down to me. But nonetheless, that kind of gives you in a nutshell what I believe is the reasoning, because it's not earnings. Earnings are not necessarily going to be that good. We're looking at another sequential decline in earnings growth this quarter, probably the same thing for next quarter. There is the hope, there is the upside and silver lining crowd that says that the following quarter, we're going to actually see some growth in earnings, which would probably be happening because we're going to be moving out of the period that we saw the significant blow to earnings on the commodity-related oil stocks, etc. Now the comparisons get much easier. This is a standard. You can't have, let's say, more than about six or, I'll go so far as saying eight quarters. Six probably, but I'll say eight. Can't have more than about eight quarters of negative growth unless things are really, really rotten somewhere. Because what happens is that even if earnings stabilize at a certain point somewhere down the road, and even if they're horrible for the first 5 or 6 months, 6 quarters, what happens is that when we look at earnings growth, we're looking at a period over period and a quarter over quarter, but a period over period and a quarter over quarter basis. And eventually the comparisons become a lot easier. That's how people look at earnings. We're looking at sequential growth over periods. And if, in fact, I have growth of, let's just say, one quarter from a sector, let's say, of a negative 25%, and the following quarter, nothing changes, and nothing changes, and nothing changes. 5 quarters later, if nothing changes, well, we're not going down anymore. And in fact, if there's any sequential move in the earnings at all, it could be very significant to the upside. In terms of growth, there was a question. We're going to get to a lot more questions from Twitter, the Twitterverse, that came in. I asked over the weekend for some questions, and we're going to get to those in a second. But there was a question that came in about, you know, should I get involved in investing during earnings season? And if so, how much should I put into that? You know, how much should I actually play in that? That's a good question. It's a little bit broad, but it's a good question. Should you get involved in playing the earnings season game? And I'm trying to find out who this is from. This is from Robert Woolridge. And here's the thing, Robert. I think that one of the things that you need to really think about is, well, how much are you going to be involved with, and why would you want to be involved, except for the fact that it's exciting. You can make some decent money on a pop. Whether you're going to go short or long is a different story. If you're going to play earnings, I would really hope that you have a good idea. But buying a stock pre-earnings is a pretty dangerous game. There's definitely some upside. And if you have a good feeling about something and some good research behind it, then it can make sense to do so. It's really no different than owning a stock and owning that stock through earnings, right? You have the stock and you're going to have it through earnings. So you can't say, can't put a blanket statement that you shouldn't own a stock during earnings, because obviously then everybody would have sold their stock prior to the earnings season coming up. Robert, if you're talking about an individual stock, it's very aggressive. If you're considering something else, I don't know if it has any significance. In other words, if you're just thinking about putting money into the markets during earnings season, I don't see that the difference between earnings season and non-earnings season makes so much of a difference. So just consider that. But again, if you're going to actually have a position on during earnings season on a new position that you add because you're saying, well, you know what? I think that IBM will do really well because, and here's my thesis. They'll be coming out Monday with earnings, by the way. And I think that the stock is beaten down for whatever reason and their earnings are going to do a lot better. You know, I see the other stocks in the industry doing better, et cetera, and I want to invest. And you want to go in the day before, let's say, looking for that pop of, you know, hoping for a 10% move. Just remember the after hours or the pre-market move post the earnings announcements are usually very volatile because they're not very liquid. And as such, you need to be very careful because you can get whipsawed around pretty well. Just keep that in mind. All right, before we talked about a variety of things here and the whole issue about market expectations with weak central banks or central banks that are just bending to every breeze that comes by and making sure that markets and seeming to have a very high level of focus on markets that has created we're not going to call it a bubble, but we're going to call it a very enthusiastic buying crowd right now. But before we go any further, let's talk a little bit about some of the economics that we saw last week and some of the economics that we're expecting for next week. Well, last week was interesting in that it was a relatively busy week. Some of the things that the Fed looks at, like the inflation rate and the PPI, some numbers on retail sales came out, but let's take a look in the beginning and go forward. So in the early part of the week on Tuesday, we saw wholesale inventories, not a really big level of importance there. Actual number came in at 0.1. Consensus was for about a 0.2. Prior was about a 0.7. Now, this is what's important about this of wholesale and business is that it goes into the GDP calculation. So that will bring down GDP a little bit. On Wednesday, we saw that export prices came in. We saw that export prices and import prices both were, we saw export prices were actually plus 0.5. Import prices, negative 0.3. So that was kind of interesting because what we want to see is that a drop in import prices and a rise in export prices. Think about that, right? We want to see a drop in import prices, lower trending import prices, higher trending export prices. That's good for U.S. companies. So that's what we got. On Thursday, initial claims, we saw that 254,000 people were actually putting in for first-time claims, and that's a little bit lower than was the prior week. PPI is an important level. PPI is the producer price index, basically inflation at the wholesale level. This came in at a plus 0.5, much more than expectations. Hotter, we call it hotter, in terms of when we talk about inflation, we talk about it in PPI, we talk about it, it came in hot. Well, it came in warm or cold. But anyway, it came a little bit hot, 0.5 versus a 0.3 and the prior 0.4. So we're still seeing that there's a continuation of the overall rise in prices and on the wholesale side, which is interesting because that would be not what you would expect with the export and import prices, which we talked about a moment ago. Now, retail sales. On Friday, we saw that retail sales, this is a very highly important number, came in at a 0.6, much better than expectations. We thought it would be anywhere from about a 0.3 to a 0.2. The last month was at a 0.2, so there's a much better number. If we take out automobiles, we got a 0.7 increase. By the way, a 0.6 and a 0.7 is not an exciting number. This is not like, wow, we are blowing the doors off the retail numbers. The consumer is out there and in droves. No, it's less than 1%. It's not exciting, but it is progress. That's the only thing that you can hold on to from the bullish camp. The whole idea that the GDP is not growing at a level that is consistent with what would be considered a very vibrant economy, but it is growing. So it's not, at least we're not going backwards at this point. The concern is that we start slowing down to a point of a stall. That's not there yet, or it may never come. But my point is that the excitement over some of these numbers is you got to kind of just put it in the perspective of where we are today, which is a general a sluggish, stagnant growth on a global basis. And any kind of glimmer of hope that we see from the levels in the U.S. that are better than expected, better than the last couple of months, trending higher, better than we see around the world is a very good thing. And for whatever reason, maybe because there's so much liquidity, maybe because we have momentum here, maybe because we did in fact fix a lot of the symptoms of what was the problem back in 2007, 2008, 2009 versus just papering them over. We did things a little bit differently. The structure of our quantitative easing, central banking, and our banks, and the structure of our economy itself is much different from an aspect of demographics, fiscal policy, and all the things that go into it, innovation, education. It's much different than Japan, China, Europe, South America. Also, the diversification that we have on many different items of export and what we need for import. A lot of those things, all the things that go into the mix. Right now, we're in the sweet spot. The U.S. is clearly doing better than many of the places around the world. And that being the case, it is the reason why there is so much money being flown, pushed into a lot of the stock market, why the stock market keeps on moving higher, why it is really not retail investors that we're seeing that are pushing it higher, but more so sovereign wealth funds, hedge funds, institutions in and outside of the U.S. Anyway, we saw CPI also after the retail sales number came up, which is also of interest. CPI was at a plus 0.2. Core CPI or headline CPI came in both at plus 0.2, which is pretty much right on where it's been. Now, this is exactly opposite of what you want to see. So if import prices going down and export prices going up are good for companies, you want to see the same thing in the relationship of PPI, which is the wholesale manufacturing, to the cost of manufacturing, if you will, to CPI, which is the cost of the final goods. You want to see CPI rising faster than PPI, because if PPI is slowly moving higher and CPI is moving much faster, what that means is that companies are able to profit better because it costs them less to manufacture than what they're actually selling on an inflation basis. We're opposite right now. Interesting. Weird. Kind of weird. What else do we see? Capacity utilization, business and inventories. Business inventories came in right on. And Michigan sentiment came in at 89.4, much lower than we've seen. It's been 94. Last month it was 93.5. So it's been that higher or mid-90s, and now it came down a little bit. Now, next week, what we're looking at is kind of an abbreviated economic reporting cycle. We have the NAHB Housing Market Index on Monday. Not a big deal, but shows us what housing participants like the builders are thinking about their outlook. It's been about 60 Looking for that to tick up a little bit higher. And then we have housing starts, building permits on Tuesday. Those are important, housing starts and building permits. Looking for a little bit of a decrease from last month on the housing starts and building permits actually rising a little bit. On Wednesday, the MBA mortgage inventories, crude inventories. But Thursday, we have a few things. We have the Philly Fed, which I think is a little bit more important. Existing home sales, we're going to be seeing. Estimates are for about 5.45 million run rate. Prior was about a 5.53, so a little bit reduction there. We have the leading indicators coming out also for June. I don't put a lot of credence in that. Last month, it was a negative 0.2. And of course, we'll see natural gas inventories, we'll see crude inventories, et cetera, come out as well. So that's kind of what's going on there. Now, in terms of earnings, though, here's what's interesting. Earnings, phew, we got, let's see here, 6 pages. I have 6 pages in front of me of earnings, of companies that are coming out on earnings. I mean, anywhere from Monday, where we have Bank America, Charles Schwab, Hasbro, J.B. Hunt, representing the banks, representing brokerages, representing the transportation industry. In the afternoon, we have, let's see, Netflix, Rambus, VMware, Yahoo, Steel Dynamics, IBM. That's just to name a few, by the way. Tuesday, before the market opens, this list, I'm not going to go on much longer than this. KC Southern, Philip Morris, Regions Financial, TD Ameritrade, United Health. There's another whole page of, where's after the market here? Let's see, after the close here on Tuesday. Cintas, the uniform company. We have Intuitive Surgical, Interactive Brokers. We got Marvell. We got Microsoft. I'm just going to kind of buzz down the list real quickly and tell you what's important. Wednesday, Abbott Labs coming out. We got Morgan Stanley, Northern Trust, St. Jude Medical, Tupperware. We got also, after the close on Wednesday, American Express. See what happens there. That's going to be interesting. Going down my list, Del Taco, eBay, F5 Networks, Intel. It's a big week. It's about 150 or so names that are coming out throughout the week. So keep your eyes open to how things play out the next 2 weeks, which is going to probably be about, let's see, of the S&P 500, probably about 200 names coming out in terms of earnings over the next 2-3 weeks. That's going to shape things. We're looking for about $113 per share total earnings on the S&P 500 for this particular quarter. And that being the case, if we do some simple math, you come up with about a 19.5 PE ratio on that, right? So let's just take a look at that math for a second. So right now, let's just say we are at currently 2170 approximately. And we'll go to clear. Let's see. Let me just look at the exact number. $21.61. So we got $21.61 divided by 113. 19.12 is the PE ratio currently on the S&P 500 on current. Forward is about 18.5. We were as high as about 20 recently. And depending on how earnings come out, will be interesting because we're at a high point here. We've looked recently at the CAPE index, the Shiller CAPE index, which is a basically it is a way of looking at PE over a long period of time. It takes the 10-year history of PEs, averages them, and kind of puts them into perspective of where we are today. When we look at this adjusted level of PE, where we're saying, well, let's take a look at all the different business cycles and what's happened over the last 10 years. And then what we could do is see kind of where we fit right now. We're still reaching the levels we saw in about 2005 to 2006. And at the high level, not as high as we saw back in 2008 when things dropped off. And because we have a 10-year period we're looking at, it really got out of whack. But we're starting to see that we're approaching levels that are pretty hot. We saw the KRI index indicator. If you saw that the key reversal indicator hit a plus 5 on one of the days last week, plus 4 for a few days. So we got some clusters formulating, which meant that there was in the next number of days, there should be corrective action to bring down that level, to bring down the froth. It doesn't have to be big. You know, it doesn't have to be a 5%. Move on the markets. Doesn't have to be the start of a new correction cycle downdraft, but you know, things got too hot. things got overdone. Things are starting to get bubbly. And when that happens, you know, we need to see a little bit of consolidation. That's how markets work. They pop, they drop, they consolidate. They pop, they drop, they consolidate. Say that along with me. Okay, ready? They pop, they drop, they consolidate. That's the bottom line. What else happens, right? They're either moving higher, they're moving lower, or they're moving sideways. Isn't that really the whole game? With stocks, with markets? That's it. So you want to be able to understand, right now we are in a position that we are in an environment with extremely, that word doesn't do this justice, but an extremely low interest rate environment with a very, very cooperative central bank policy. The more things happen that are bad, it seems the more that central banks will push in and create higher levels of stocks. Because what's happening is that they are just so panicked about everything. Now, we saw also, let's move a little bit onto a couple different things. Before I do that, let me mention that on this upcoming Tuesday, which is the 18th? No, let's see. 17th? 19th? 19th, I think it's 19th. At 9 a.m., I will be on the Benzinga Morning Show, talking about markets and things of that nature. If you could probably see it, I'll post it somewhere. But you can listen to it live as well on going over to Benzinga.com at 9 a.m. We also saw that there was some interesting things that happened over the last week. Probably one of my favorite things that happened over the past week was this gigantic move lower. This big move for the yen. After Ben Bernanke had a visit with Japan's finance ministers, did you see this? Where they floated the idea, or at least in theory, the idea of a perpetual bond. The heck is that? A perpetual bond. In other words, the government would issue bonds at, let's say, I don't know, I'm thinking, maybe 0%, an eighth of a percent, maybe negative, with no maturity. Never has to be paid back. Just perpetual. Just here's money on loan forever. And the central bank would give them money. Here's a fun game. You know, in other words, what's the point? The whole point of doing the whole point of the central bank not creating money just from nowhere is and sterilizing it by buying bonds is to keep a balance. We'll call it a balance between the long-term nature of having to pay that back and to bring it back out of the economy to just simply providing what we have called and termed helicopter money by just taking money and creating money and just spreading it out there somehow, just throwing it out there into the government that will then put it out to the people, into the markets, just whatever it may be. We know that Japan, by the way, uses a lot of their money to buy things like stocks and ETFs in the current markets, in the domestic markets. And we also know very clearly that they buy stocks of companies, ETFs, mutual funds, things of that nature, outside of their own environment. Does anybody think that that has anything to do with the current valuations of our market? Hello? Don't tell anybody that's what's going on, though. Please don't. Listen, the bullish argument is we want to believe that everybody is very optimistic about stocks and that people are going in and all this. But the fact of the matter is there's another bullish argument. The other bullish argument is, hey, you know what? Well, central banks and sovereign wealth funds and hedge funds outside of the U.S. are just going to be piling in because they're getting free money from non-sterilized, central bank actions. What I mean by non-sterilized is this new perpetual bonds. Now, what happened is the markets kind of somehow got a leak of this. I mean, what do you think of that? It's leaks. The markets got leaked information about this. And what happened was that the yen went from about 100 to 105, about a 5% move lower for the yen, which then put a tremendous amount of steam under the markets because we know how very sensitive and highly correlated Japanese markets are to the move of the yen. We also saw in China just a massive amount of economic data released over the past week. One of the things I thought was really interesting was that economic output by real estate brokers surged about 8.5% from a year ago through the April-June period, while construction activities jumped about 7.5%. Now, the GDP on a total basis grew at about 6.7%. Some other industries, such as technology, health, and education, had about a 9% gain. But here's something to consider. While GDP beat expectations slightly, the fact that there was, you heard it here, a new calculation used to formulate the GDP, and that we knew very recently would add about $139 billion total to GDP for China because of this revamping of their calculation, probably had something to do with the overall beat. These are the little things that somehow escape those journalists that are providing us the news. They report on one hand a few days ago that there's going to be a new and revitalized and revamped and changed calculation to the GDP, which will in fact add about $139 billion. About 2 days later, when they actually come out with the GDP numbers, they conveniently forget to include that little footnote that while GDP beat by just a slight amount, the fact is that it's hard to really compare because there is a new calculation being used that is adding just a tremendous amount, $139 billion. Hello? This is not chicken change here. This is not small amounts of pennies found around the couch. This is a lot of money that is being added to the bottom line of, this is kind of like a company saying, you know what, we're going to change the way we do our earnings calculation and, you know, we're going to make an extra like, you know, $10 million, $15, $20 million. And the company comes out a few days later and says, hey, you know what, good news. Expectations were for us to make, $10 million. We really made $15 or $18 million net. And our EPS is up 5 cents over expectations. Well, is it magic? No, it's because they changed the calculation. Kind of reminds me of the Jerry Lewis movie, right? Don't raise the bridge, lower the water. Kind of it's depending on how you look at what's going on in terms of calculation statistics. All the terms on really what is happening. Anyway, a couple more things before we get to some of our questions. How about that coup attempt in Turkey? Kind of weird how that whole thing went down. Very strange how fast it erupted and how fast it was put down, especially because the president was not even anywhere nearby and then somehow magically helicoptered in, and once he got there, everything stopped. A little weird. Well, meanwhile, on that move, after the market closed on Friday, like a Friday night dump where companies come out with all sorts of bad news on a Friday night. They don't want to do it during market hours because, sheesh, things can go kind of weird. But it happens right after the market closes on Friday in the U.S., very well timed, into the weekend. Just enough time to clean it up. Markets dropped from a currency standpoint about 4%. So the Turkish lira dropped about 4.2% against the dollar once the news was actually released. And then there, the TUR, the Turkish stock market ETF that's traded here in the U.S., traded on the aftermarket hours, down about 7%. In the U.S., the futures were down about 60 basis points, about 13 or 14 points on the S&P 500. Kind of interesting. And then by the time things were over, by the time the market closed, it was down about 40, 50 basis points. I would imagine now that it seems that nothing really happened and Erdogan is back in power. This is all going to reverse just beautifully on Sunday evening. Really no opportunity for most to do anything with this information after the market closed on Friday. And then we'll see what happens as it was cleaned up over the weekend, and like nothing ever happened on Sunday night. How many times have we seen this kind of thing happen? Like nothing ever happened. You know what I mean? A vote on a Friday or on a Thursday, end of week, you know, with Brexit, kind of let the weekend go by, and then on Monday, Tuesday, it's like nothing ever happened. Let's talk about Herbalife for a second. Then we're going to get some questions from the listeners. I thought it was a really interesting story that Herbalife came out with an announcement, actually, that the FTC was fining them $200 million, the symbol HLF, The FTC is out with a fine of $200 million and a requirement of the company to actually change in a very big way many of their marketing and operational functions. Now, what was interesting was the FTC fined them $200 million and it said you have to change a lot of your practices. Now, for the most part, you would think, well, that's bad news. Yeah, something's not right. But I guess because the company was not labeled a pyramid scheme or multi-level marketing, not shut down, the stock actually rallied. It was up at 1.18% after this information came out. A lot of shorts have been leaning against Herbalife along with Bill Ackman, the famous, quote-unquote famous, hedge fund manager. And I guess it was a condemnation of the company from what I read. And I was really confused about this and thinking, well, you know, I get why many people may be saying, you know what? It doesn't look like this company is going to go under to a zero as Bill Ackman had predicted. Yeah, I'm just going to cover my short and get the hell out of here at this point, especially because it hasn't been working. The short side of the story has not been working when it comes to Herbalife. Take a look at that stock chart. But I started thinking about this and, you know, I started also thinking about that if they have to change a lot of their practices on recruiting, maybe marketing, how they actually do business. It seems to me from a read through with that and the fact that there was a big fine that maybe they were edging on the, just on the edge, dancing just on the edge of being a pyramid scheme, if you will, or a multi-level marketing company, whatever you want to call it, that is illegal. And the government says, you know what, listen, you are tiptoeing very close to the edge here. Actually, maybe you're really over the edge. But, you know, if we shut you down, a lot of people are going to get hurt. So what we're going to do is you're going to have to pay a lot and you're going to have to change your practices. Otherwise, we'll shut you down. What do you think? And Herbalife says, okay, I get it. We will comply and change all these tactics. Now, if they do so, it's kind of like what happened with Valiant, right? It's the same play. It's interesting. The same guy, Ackman. On one side, he's really pro-Valiant in that all their practices that they had to goose up their earnings and do things by building up debt and then rolling it into other companies by then absorbing other companies and then having the whole debt roll, having earnings move by pushing and goosing the price of drugs and going through this whole process. You know, that's okay. He loves that whole thing. But the way Herbalife is doing it, he doesn't like. But anyway, same guy on two sides of a weird spectrum. But as Valiant was no longer able to do the same kind of business that they were doing, and they now have a new business model, which is a nice business model, a playing nice business model, look at what happened to the stock. The stock has cratered. It's crumbled. It's gone. It's like at $22. Now, will the same thing happen with Herbalife? Even though Ackman was not right in terms, maybe he is right, but he wasn't right in terms of the FTC coming out and saying, hey, this is going to be a pyramid scheme, this is going to be a multi-level marketing deal, this is going to be shut down. Maybe what's happening here is by the very nature of them having to comply, not even so much about the $200 million fine here. Maybe because they have to comply with all of these new rules and regulations in terms of how they do business, this stock is headed for trouble. Just think about that. All right, let's get to some questions from some listeners. All right, where do we start? Let's start with Gibbous. Oh, Gibbous. Gibbous? You know who you are. He asked me the question, after witnessing everything, what are your thoughts on Nintendo Pokemon since the last episode? Well, he's talking about my commentary and John Dvorak's commentary on DH Unplugged, where John picked Nintendo as a play, a stock to actually buy for this game that we play on DH Unplugged that we do each and every week. Check it out over there, dhunplugged.com, podcast, etc. I would have to say that probably a fad, first of all. Let's just get that straight. You know, I know it sounds, when you're in the middle of the whole thing, it's like, oh my God, this is a major thing for the forever and ever and ever. You know, I'm driving around town and I see people with their phones kind of walking around like, I call them Pokezoms, which is Pokezombies. And you know, this is definitely something that can be very interesting. There's a lot of different applications for this. I think from an advertising standpoint, from a drawing in of potential customers to places to find the, you know, restaurants, dry cleaners, various places around town to show that, you know, if there is a Pokemon hiding in a gym and all the other things that go along with this crazy game, it's very good for Nintendo. So I think that it's also good, though, for other companies. And this is just a model for what could be something very much bigger. Now, this, listen, if you look at the history of this, this is no different than a couple other games that were out there in the past. It's just a much better way of presenting it, a much more user-friendly, much more, we'll call it colorful, animation of the same idea. So I think it's kind of a cool thing, but I don't know. I mean, Nintendo's up, what, 80%, 75% since the last week when this was announced? And I do think there's a craze. I think it will wear off a little bit, and I'm not saying that to be a Debbie Downer. Wah, wah, wah. You know, I'm not saying it that way. I'm just saying that, you know, I've seen these things before, and the reality is I probably give it 2 months for it to die down, and then the reality is set in, and then somehow Nintendo's going to have to try to figure out a way to make some money from this in a much bigger way. Now, this is an off-topic question, but JCM Now, let's see if there's anything else more on this here now. JCM Now is asking me the question. We understand your wife is a private sector service just for you with regard to vacations. Question is about vacation pack. I guess he wants to know how I find all these great places that I go to. I watch a lot of Anthony Bourdain and Andrew Zimmern. I watch whatever I can with that. I also, you know, Travel Channel, but also try to find some of the places around the world that are undiscovered. We don't do vacation packages. My wife actually spends a time working with private tour guides on Facebook and on Tours by Locals. I love that site, by the way, toursbylocals.com. used a few of them in Panama, and great. I just thought the whole thing was great. Great way to find people. You want to look at things like TripAdvisor. Make sure to be careful and scrutinize the reviews for people that you think are real reviews versus not real reviews. We try to figure out looking at the way they write, you know, if they have strange grammatical inconsistencies that don't seem to be that they know the language very well, then we kind of ditch them and don't really read those. But we just try to find great places to go around the world. Sorry, that answer is not very good. Next question, stocks and bonds. This is from Brad Fairchild. Stocks and bonds are at or near record levels, which seems unsustainable. Should the average Joe go to cash and wait for a correction? You know, there's two schools of thoughts on this, Brad. So first of all, let me state this one point. You got to be in it to win it. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be in it long or short. You can be long and short. But that doesn't mean you have to be fully invested either, right? So you have to be playing the game to actually get anything going. When you're in cash, you're not going to be making any money at all. And two things can happen. One, markets will move down and you may, in fact, have some cash available to redeploy. That's good. If, in fact, you are good at that, if, in fact, you are believing that you can market time, which from a timing aspect, just on a simple methodology, is kind of hard. There are other ways to actually skin the same cat, but just going with a market timing is a little bit hard, in and out. It does look like an opportunity at this point to definitely pare back some positioning. Our arrow strategy is actually short, and the KRI, the key reversal indicator, is waving a very cautious tone. I've seen other things like Stochastics, RSI, Spearman, a variety of things. McClellan, I believe, also. Although that's a little bit different. A lot of things are flashing a warning sign. And it does also look like we could have seen a little bit of an exhaustion push to a new high. Capitulation high. Maybe the shorts saying, hey, we got above the highs. We're going to blow out our position here. We've been waiting a long time. We haven't been able to get out of this trading range. And once it did get out of its trading range, the shorts said, I'm done. So they, you know, then have to buy shares. They have to unwind their position. So I do think that it, you know, it's not the worst time. As a matter of fact, a client who's been sitting on the sideline because they just don't like the market, somebody that's been a client of mine for, 20 years, 25 years. On Friday, actually entered a short position. We talked to them about it for a long time. Asked me, he said, you know, should I go short? This is going on months now. I said, well, you know what? You're in cash. Do you really want to do that right now and all that? And we talked about it on Friday. I said, you know what? Maybe now of all times that I could think about is probably a really good time to think about. Again, there's a different type of client, different situation. He just didn't even like the market to be involved in anything recently. But yeah, I mean, I think same thing with bonds. I mean, you know, you're hitting a high level here. And the reasons really aren't good why stocks are going up. Stocks are going up because there's a lot of central bank activity. Central bank activity because there's a lot of negative headwinds, headlines, and things going on around the world, as well as the fact that bonds are very much, you know, low and there's not many other alternatives. Okay, let's see. Well, this is a question right on that topic. Hazizi asked me, with bond yields at record lows, does conventional wisdom about holding bonds as part of a diversified portfolio still hold? I've been asking this question for the last 2 years. And we have actually, what we've done is we've taken for our global allocation portfolios, we've actually taken the exposure of bonds and shortened up the maturities and duration so that we still have participation with bonds, with bond yields. But what happens is that because we've shortened up the maturities, the actual interest rate fluctuation risk and the skew, as we call it, from the potential of bonds moving much higher very quickly and then seeing or bond yields moving higher quickly won't really hurt the portfolio that much. So we were getting the bang for the buck by shortening up and continuing to shorten up as time went on in terms of duration and maturity. And you could do that through ETFs and mutual funds. And at the same time, having the exposure to the bond so I get the yield. So just to restate something about your question, which I think is important, and I think this will answer your question very clearly. And I think for everybody listening, I want you to listen along with what I'm about to say. I'm going to read this again. With bond yields at record lows, does conventional wisdom about holding bonds as part of a diversified portfolio still hold? If you have a desire of having a diversified portfolio, you have to have diversified instruments. Those that will not, in fact, work all together in a up or down fashion. In other words, not correlated in a way that they all move together. As crazy as that sounds, that while bonds and stocks have been somewhat moving together, you may want to make sure that the bonds that you have don't have a high correlation to the stocks that you have. So you have to look at both and understand where that's playing. If you have high yield stocks and high yield bonds, they're probably going to move together. If you have growth stocks and low duration bonds, probably not going to say have the same correlation. So one may be up or both may be up, but really one will trail up a little bit differently and one moves down, one moves up, but at least you have some diversification there. Cal Watts asked me, hey, what about thoughts on copper? I read how copper is a good reaction to world economy. Is that true? They used to call copper Dr. Copper, that you follow copper and you can follow the global economy. And in other words, if copper is going up, well, the economy is doing better. Copper's going down. Well, the economy's not doing so well on a global basis. Some of that relationship broke when everybody got involved in quantitative easing and stimulus around the world. Because what happened was all of a sudden currency started moving, and that in itself affected copper. You also had stockpiling that was going on by China to a level that was just unsustainable, and all of a sudden they stopped stockpiling, and all of a sudden the price of copper plummeted. On the other hand, we're seeing a lot of copper mines, smelters, and all the things that go along with copper close down, shut down. Well, that's going to bring the price up. So there's a lot of artificial mechanisms right now that are going on that may, in fact, move copper higher, possibly, without it really meaning that the economy is getting better. Unfortunately, the bottom line to this conversation right now is that because of all the excessive amount of central bank actions, it has broken the correlations, the traditional correlations of many different asset classes. This goes to a lot of the conversations we've had. And because of the fact that there is a break and a breakdown in the correlations, it's very difficult to really get a handle on what means what anymore. Gene Everett asked me, what is the best stock or ETF to own for a long gold investment? Basically, aside from holding physical gold, what's next best? Well, I mean, GLD is the paper traded gold backed ETF that pretty much everybody holds if you want gold. GDX is the gold miners. The one-time gold miners. So you can hold them too. So ETFs, I think those are the best. Anyway, I think wrap up all the questions. I had a few more here. I'll answer some of those maybe next week or on DH Unplugged. If you want some more information on how to get in touch with me, just write to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Don't forget to listen in on DH Unplugged each and every week on Tuesday nights, Wednesdays. And of course, as I mentioned, I'll be appearing on Benzinga Morning Show on next Tuesday at 9 a.m. We'll make sure to put a tweet up there and some other information on the website over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, where you can find out more information on how we manage money and what we do and how we actually do the things that we do, in fact, do. So hopefully you'll join me over there and check it out, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check it out. Anyway, I'll see you next week. We have some great guests coming up. We have Dr. Daniel Crosby with The Laws of Wealth, a great book, which I am in the midst of reading right now. I want you to make sure to listen to that. And shout out to all of you who asked all those questions and helped us out on this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Until next week, I'll see you then. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.